From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announced this morning she's experiencing dementia, most likely Alzheimer's. The 88-year-old recently withdrew from public life. After her retirement, she'd spoken about changes on the High Court and in American politics generally. The impact of Justice O'Connor right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's off to a great start. Such pleasure to be with you today. Coming up a little bit later, L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald is running for re-election. He's being challenged by our guest of yesterday, Alex Villanueva. Today, the sheriff with us in studio to talk about his candidacy. But first, retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announced this morning she's experiencing the early stages of dementia, most likely Alzheimer's disease. She became the first woman on the High Court in 1981. O'Connor was nominated by Ronald Reagan. Here's what she had to say back in 2009, this at the Aspen Ideas Festival, when she related what led up to her selection.
I know that William French Smith was the Attorney General when I was selected, and he told me that because President Reagan had indicated during his campaign that if he had a chance, he'd like to put a qualified woman on the Supreme Court. And Attorney General Smith began collecting a few names. Well, his list was pretty short because there weren't many women judges, and there were even fewer Republican women judges. So his list was pretty short. He kept it under his telephone at the Department of Justice. And sure enough, there was a vacancy, and William French Smith put out his pitiful little list, and there I was. So I ended up on the court.
Justice O'Connor retired 12 years ago, but continued making public appearances. You know, compared to the other justices, she was young when she retired. Justice O'Connor is important not only because of the seminal cases in which she rendered the deciding vote, often the swing vote. She's an important figure for women in leadership, particularly in law. And if you are a woman in the legal profession, I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say about the significance of Justice O'Connor and her being the first woman in this highest of all positions in American law. 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'll also be reading some excerpts from the letter that Justice O'Connor put out about her retreat from public life and her continuing to live in the Phoenix area, where, of course, she grew up. I mean, she's distinctly an Arizonan, too, and a Westerner, Stanford Law School, top student there, coming out of Arizona, a very important part of who she is as well. 866-893-KPECC. Also, if you're someone who had a friend or a family member or has someone who's a friend or family member with dementia, and it's a prominent individual, I'm curious about how you sort of manage this process of, you know, someone who has been a very important voice in your life, very important touchstone, about the loss of memory, the dementia that comes over time, and how you've dealt with that process. 866-893-KPECC. Or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is Kimberly West Falcone, who is law professor at Loyola Law School. Her focus includes constitutional law. Professor West Falcone, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm starting with you to find out the significance, not just Justice O'Connor as a legal giant, but being the first woman on the High Court, the significance of that for you.
Well, there's absolutely no question that when I think of Justice O'Connor, her place in history as the first woman on the United States Supreme Court was monumental and had an impact that I know she was personally very proud of, and that we can see the trailblazing she's done in the record number of women, which is still small compared to the whole history of the court, but the record number of women who currently sit on the court. I certainly associate her as a justice who provided a diversity on the court in a number of ways, though, in addition to the gender diversity that she represents. I've always taught my students and mentioned her in the context of providing a kind of occupational diversity that the court lacks now, that she's not a law professor. She was not a law professor type when she joined the court. She was a former state senator, and I think there was a pragmatism and an experience with being able to negotiate and reach consensus that kind of jurist, someone who's been elected a number of times and who's really focused on the idea of civic participation, I think she brought something very special to the court and then in her life after the court that says she's a very unique individual.
Is there any way you can point to her gender specifically factoring into either her demeanor on the court or the role she played or even decisions that she wrote, any way that you see her gender playing out specifically?
Well, I thought it was interesting in the clip that you played. I think she reflected a humility in how she saw herself as a woman on the court. That it may have something to do, though, with her, again, no disrespect to law professors, of which I'm one, she was not a staunch ideological justice on the court. And so she reached conclusions and opinions that were criticized by some opponents of abortion, opponents of race-based affirmative action, that it could very well be that her experience as a woman led her to look at certain issues, and I believe she is probably on record of saying that sort of thing, that led her to look at certain issues in the context of gender discrimination, whether it was ruling on the same-sex sex in Lawrence versus Texas. She reached numerous conclusions that did not fit in line with an activist concern. Mm-hmm. I think there was a way in which she was reserved that could very well reflect her position and her experience as a woman in the time that she came of age.
We're talking with Loyola Law School professor Kimberly West Falcon, joining us on Air Talk. And again, our phones are open. If you are a woman in law and look at Sandra Day O'Connor as an important figure, perhaps inspirational, or someone to look to as a woman who broke ground as the first U.S. Supreme Court justice who was a woman. I'm interested in your thoughts about this. 866-893-KPECC. And also, if there's a prominent person in your life, matriarchal, patriarchal figure, friend or family member who has gone through dementia, Alzheimer's or not, how you've gone through that process of someone who sort of everyone looked to for leadership, for strength, and to see the decline over time that happens, and how you and others, families and family members and friends have dealt with it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Cynthia in San Pedro, I understand your mother was an attorney?
Yes, my mother was an attorney. She was a teacher first and then went back to school when I was in high school and got her law degree, and she was a huge influence. I became an attorney, and I really miss her, and it was really difficult to see such a strong, intelligent woman start to lose her faculties. It was very difficult.
It's got to be very, very, very tough, especially, you know, you're being in the same profession, and so not just your mom, but workmate as well.
Yes, it was the whole family. My sister was a paralegal, and
wow,
was involved, and we all worked very hard together. She was dynamic. She was awesome. She won an appeal because she was so strong and really knew the law and really put her case forward and helped her client immensely. She was a woman who hardly was allowed to own property in 1976. So it's just been hard.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Cynthia, thank you so much for sharing the experience. We appreciate it. 866-893-KPCC. Barry McDonald, law professor at Pepperdine University. You have some personal stories to share about Justice O'Connor. Professor, you know, share with us your thoughts about what you saw when you were a clerk for the Supreme Court.
Oh, well, thank you, Larry. I'm sure Professor Valla can address many more stories since he clerked for Justice O'Connor, but I just remember when I clerked for Chief Justice Rehnquist, and he was good friends with Justice O'Connor. They were both, Chief Justice Rehnquist, they both went to Stanford Law School. Chief Justice Rehnquist practiced law in Arizona, Justice O'Connor, you know, before coming east to Washington. And so I think they felt a special bond and affinity towards each other. I think in terms of their jurisprudence, Chief Justice Rehnquist was a little bit more conservative. Justice O'Connor staked out a ground in the middle. She was a true moderate, and she believed more than a lot of the conservative judges in sort of the capacity and ability of judges to sort of weigh competing values and come to sensible solutions. She was criticized for that, as Professor Wes Falken mentioned in her sort of balancing approach in abortion cases, for example, in affirmative action. I think she was criticized by many of the conservatives for not being more sort of doctrinaire or rules oriented. But I think she, more than anything that sort of characterized Justice O'Connor, was her common sense. She's just seem to exude this level-headed approach to different issues.
Professor McDonald, thank you for being with us. I know you have to run and appreciate your spending time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Barry McDonald, Pepperdine University law professor, and the just mentioned Eugene Volokh, UCLA law professor, who I'm sure has so many stories to share about Justice O'Connor. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Always great to be on.
First of all, what's your response to the statement that she put out this morning?
I'm sorry?
What's your response to the statement that Justice O'Connor put out this morning?
On one hand, of course, it's very sad to see someone that one knows and respects be so ill. At the same time, you know, this is a culmination of a very long life and a remarkable, remarkable career. As a lawyer, as a politician, as a justice, after that as an advocate for civics education, she is a remarkable woman, and I think she ought to be an example to us all. I do think that she's, my sense is that she's been particularly inspirational to women lawyers, and by the way, my guess is women lawyers on both sides of the political divide. One thing people talk about diversity, one thing that she highlights is a reminder, which is sometimes easy to forget, that there's a huge diversity in the views of women judges and women lawyers. She was a fairly conservative Republican, and her position on the court and it led her to be kind of a moderate conservative voice from a jurisprudential perspective. And she also had diversity of views within herself, as most of us do. She wasn't always predictably conservative or predictably liberal or even predictably moderate. And I think that just reminds us that she was a person. She was the first woman justice, but she was also a person with her own kind of complicated views about life and about the law. And that's one of the things that I think all of us who worked for her loved about her.
What do you see as the most important cases where she was the deciding vote?
You know, there were many. I think one of the things that was very near to her heart was reaffirming the rights of states under the Constitution, and in particular the limits on federal power. I think, like pretty much all the justices on the court, with a possible exception maybe of Justice Thomas, but I'm not even sure about him. I think she believed that the federal government ought to have very broad powers in many ways, but not unlimited powers. With respect to the states. So there are some things, even setting aside the Bill of Rights constraints, some things that were just outside of the scope of the federal government. And I think she was often not just a necessary fifth vote for that to happen, but she was also an influence on the other justices in that she was the one who I think helped push for a lot of these arguments. I think she also had particular views about race-based affirmative action. She was generally highly skeptical about it in cases involving employment and contracting. She was somewhat more open to it in education, although even there she thought there ought to be some limits on that. And ultimately, her position ended up being the position of the court because she was the swing vote there. But those are just a couple of examples. She had strong views about religion and the law. She was a backer of religious exemptions from generally applicable laws for religious objectors. She lost that battle in the Employment Division versus Smith case, but I think she fought it because she deeply believed in it. She was also a backer of some limits, although not very broad limits, on the government's power to express religious views. So she is the pioneer of the endorsement test that bars the government from endorsing religion. There are many, many others. She was a very influential justice, not just because of her swing vote, but I think because of the force of her reasoning and her personality.
Eugene, thank you as always. I appreciate your being on with us, particularly with your firsthand experience. I only met her once, and that was several years ago. We were at a table together at an event, and it was such a pleasure to get to talk with her. I just had this feeling I was in the presence of living history, and even just that short, you know, being with her for an hour made an impression on me. Thank you, Eugene. As always, appreciate it. Eugene Volokh, UCLA law professor, clerked for Justice O'Connor. By the way, her letter reads, some time ago, doctors diagnosed me with the beginning stages of dementia, probably Alzheimer's disease. As this condition has progressed, I'm no longer able to participate in public life. Since many people have asked about my current status and activities, I want to be open about these changes. And while I am still able, share some personal thoughts. And goes on to talk about the importance of the iCivics program that she started to teach civics to middle and high school students. Says, I will continue living in Phoenix, Arizona, surrounded by dear friends and family. While the final chapter of my life with dementia may be trying, nothing has diminished my gratitude and deep appreciation for the countless blessings in my life. How fortunate I feel to be an American and to have been presented with the remarkable opportunities available to the citizens of our country. As a young cowgirl from the Arizona desert, I never could have imagined that one day I would become the first woman justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. That this morning's letter released from Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'll be back in a minute. Listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Part of our continuing coverage of the November 6th election, we focus on the LA County Sheriff's race. Yesterday, the challenger, Alex Villanueva, was with us in studio. Today, it's Sheriff Jim McDonald, who is running for re-election. Sheriff, good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
Now, I'm disturbed to find out you're a Red Sox fan. Is that right?
You know, I grew up down the street from Fenway Park, but I love the Dodgers as well.
I don't know. That may cost you some votes. I don't know.
I hope not.
We'll see by by November 6th. So I want to start, first of all, with your challenger's contention that you have failed to reform the department in ways that it needs to be reformed. He claims that you've actually made deputies who were working the jails overly cautious for fear of complaints against them, that that's endangered them, and that there's been more inmate violence. So your response, first of all, to that critique?
You know, there has been an increase in inmate-on-inmate violence. He also says there's been an increase in inmate-on-staff violence. That's not the case. There's a number of things he's putting out there that are not accurate, and I'd be happy to address any of those. When I look at where we were 4 years ago, we had just come out of the largest scandal in the history of the organization. Things were not going well in the jails at all, and as a result, we got consent decrees with a federal judge overseeing our operation. In that time, the most recent briefing I've had from the monitor team who works for the federal judge said that they have seen a positive sea change in 4 years in the way that our staff treat inmates. I walk through the jails and I'm frequently stopped by inmates who say, you know what, I've been in and out of here my whole adult life and I have never been treated as well as I am today, where I actually feel like people care about me doing better. And to get that from an inmate who has nothing to gain from telling me that is really validating that the work that our men and women throughout the organization are doing are paying big dividends. I see a difference in attitude within the custody environment and throughout the department. And I'm very proud of the work that's being done. We are in a very different place today than we were 4 years ago, and I'm proud of that. We have systems of accountability. I put in place constitutional policing advisors within the organization, worked with, when I was on the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence, worked to appoint an inspector general that now has a full staff with complete access to the entire department. We have a civilian oversight commission. I started a bureau within the department, the Audit and Accountability Bureau, that has access throughout the department. And my hope is if there's a problem, we find it and we fix it and we move forward and constantly looking to be better.
So to what do you attribute the lack of support from the Deputies Association?
Well, you know, you look at when you're trying to reform an organization, it's cause for change, and people don't like change, and it seems particularly those in the policing profession are resistant to change. You know, so I understand that. I grew up in the policing culture, but there's a tremendous need. We owe it to the communities that we serve to be the very best that we can. And like I mentioned earlier, we came out of the darkest period in the history of the organization, so we had a lot of work to do to be able to regain public trust and to be able to move forward in a way that we restore our credibility within the profession across the United States, but more importantly, the trust of the people that we serve throughout the county.
So if you're reelected, then what are the ways you have in mind to try and rebuild support from the deputies' union?
Well, it was the union union board that made this decision. It was not the union members that voted on this particular endorsement. So I talk to deputies every day throughout the organization. And while morale is a tough issue anywhere in policing in America today, I look at our organization and people are out there. All of the indicators of good morale are in place. Our people are working hard. Arrests are up. Crime is down. Counterterrorism is robust. When you look across the organization, we've made tremendous strides on so many different fronts, and people are engaged. They're not backing away from the duties that they take on. They're doing proactive, good police work every day out there. So I'm very proud of what they're doing, and I would argue the point about the morale issue. I'd say it is as positive here as it is in any police organization in America.
We're talking with Los Angeles County Sheriff Jim McDonald. If you have questions for him, you can put it on our page, kpcc.org/airtalk, the AirTalk page. You can also call with a question at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Your challenger, Mr. Villanueva, also said that your command staff, and he essentially said they're cronies, that this is the carryover from the Lee Baca days when he was sheriff, the days when Mark Tanaka was heading up the division that controlled the jails. Your response to that? He said he's clean house of your command staff.
Yeah, he talks a good game. Obviously, he either not being forthright or he doesn't understand the civil service process, that when he comes into an organization, if he thinks that he can possibly just remove the top layers of the organization, everybody has civil service protection to the rank of commander. So the most he could do with people at the rank of undersheriff, assistant sheriff, or chief would be to demote them to commander. He's got a limited number of spots for commanders. So what he's talking about doing, first of all, is not realistic at all. And we have people in within the organization have tremendous talent, could be chiefs of police pretty much anywhere in the United States, and I'm very proud of the team we have. But to say we have the same team in place that we had four years ago, over 80% of those kept at the rank of captain and above have transitioned to either different positions, promoted, retired, or are in a different place today, certainly, than they were before. So when I look at the the claim that the same people are in the same place and I haven't done anything, We have a tremendous team, people I'm very proud of, but people, a tremendous amount of change has gone on at the upper levels of the organization.
Sheriff, a recent KPCC report found at least $17 million has been paid out by the county in sexual misconduct allegation cases involving sheriff's personnel. That's since the middle of 2004, so it averages more than $1 million a year. And it makes up about half of all the dollar amounts of the settlements for the county's entire workforce when it comes to sexual misconduct cases. I don't know how that compares to other law enforcement agencies versus their total staffs, but does the number concern you? If so, what plans do you have to address that?
Sure. Any number would concern me, particularly in light of the allegations that would be involved there. We have had some of those cases in my 4 years, and we have addressed them very aggressively. We got right on it. We put our whole team on it to be able to chase down the information, get the facts together, and to be able to take appropriate action. We've done that in a couple of different cases. When I look at the trend since 2004, we have 18,000 employees in our organization. So, you know, we as hard as we try and say that, you know, things that we're not proud of will never happen is unrealistic. Things will happen, and it's really more what we do when they do and how we deal with them as we move forward. So we are trending down in our risk management focus as it relates to lawsuits. Lawsuits take 3 to 4 or 5 years to be able to get through the system. So we're watching very closely. The major drivers of that are deputy-involved shootings, use of force incidents, and then other misconduct, like you mentioned, with sexual harassment issues. We have comprehensive training throughout the organization. We have set the tone very clearly from my first day as to expectations and what we would tolerate and what we wouldn't. And we're in a place where I'm very proud that everyone in the organization knows what's expected of them. We have seen a decrease in people relieved from duty here as we've moved forward. And we're in a place where, you know, it's not something you can ever check the box and say we're done, but we're on the road to being the best organization, I believe, in American policing.
The county uses quite frequently with the settlements non-disclosure agreements. Do you think that that's a good idea, or do you think that the specifics of the settlements should be made public?
You know, I'm a fan of transparency. I don't know enough about that topic. That's something that's done by county council with the opposing council. I don't know what the rationale is other than maybe to protect victims of this, to be able to protect their identity so that people who have been a victim of sexual harassment or something else are not out there in the public eye.
With the women that are working for the department, is there any difference in turnover? Because that could be a red flag that perhaps women in the department are not feeling as welcomed. Do you see any difference in the turnover between women and men on the sheriff's department?
You know, nothing that certainly is noticeable, and we make an effort to be able to interview people when they leave us exit interviews to be able to, as best we can, to determine why they left. When any allegations are made of anything inappropriate, we take them very seriously, and we have as an organization for a long time. We have Internal Affairs, Internal Criminal Investigations Bureau, as well as the policy of equity throughout the organization for issues that relate to this issue. So for many years, we have taken it very seriously, and I think that has set the foundation for where we are today. We have over 18% of our workforce sworn side is female, a much larger number on the professional staff side. So we are probably in a position where we have one of the highest percentages of female employees within the policing profession. I'm very proud of that, but certainly we want to continue to try and build our numbers and be as representative as we can of every demographic throughout the county.
Sheriff McDonald, I want to talk about your experience versus your opponent. That's something that you've emphasized during your campaign. So draw that distinction, please.
Yeah, you know, I come having been 37 years plus in the business. I've been in three organizations. I rose from a recruit in the LAPD up to number two. Left there, went to the Long Beach Police Department as chief, and now sheriff for 4 years. I look back on my time in the command ranks, and my opponent has never had a command. He retired as a lieutenant, so he's never managed a budget. We have a $3.3 billion budget. He's never overseen training. He's never overseen discipline. He's never overseen any of the basic 101 things in police command responsibilities. So to come into an organization that's the largest sheriff's department in the world, second largest police department in the United States behind NYPD, and to try and say that you're going to be able to get up to speed quickly and be able to manage an organization where over 10 million people are relying on you for their safety is not fair to him. It's not fair to the organization, and certainly not fair to the public throughout Los Angeles County.
So his claim is, well, that there are other staff people that can deal with that while he gets up to speed.
Well, he'll have no credibility with those staff people coming in relying on everybody to give him the answers to what's going on. You have to come in and be in a position where you can take charge of an organization. You have the credibility among the people that you have the privilege to lead, but you're able to move forward and respond to whatever comes your way. And I'll tell you, day in and day out, it's one emergency after another that we deal with. If we deal with it effectively, the public doesn't even notice. We move forward. But coming in without the experience, I've been a command officer for over 20 years. That's 20 years of experience in three different organizations at every level that he has never had. I look back on when I was a lieutenant, and a lieutenant's a great spot. It's a responsible spot. He was responsible in his last command for up to 18 people. He's looking to go into an organization of 18,000 people. It's a very different job.
Sheriff McDonald, thank you for being with us. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Larry.
I
appreciate it.
Jim McDonald, L.A. County Sheriff, running for re-election. Alex Villanueva is the challenger. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We have much more to come after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. One of the very biggest of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions handed down at the end of the last term came in June. Janus versus the American Federation of State, Municipal, and County Employees. The decision was that public employees who have historically been contributing fair share payments to a union, doing collective bargaining on their behalf, should not be required to make those fair share payments. Now, that's for those who choose not to be members of the union, not to be represented by them. Historically, there was the view that public employees, if they're being represented in collective bargaining, should have to pay something toward that service. But the High Court held otherwise, and joining us is the gentleman who was a plaintiff in that case, Mark Janus. The case again decided in a 5-4 decision in favor of Mr. Janus. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Larry. Glad to be here.
So how has your life changed, if it has, in the past few months, past last 4 or 5 months?
Well, it's been a roller coaster, quite frankly, you know, with the highs of the decision coming out in our favor. And then, of course, the low being that now I don't have any time for myself anymore.
Well, and I'm sure your hope and others who supported you in this legal challenge to the fair share payments were hopeful that this would lead to public employee unions not being able to collect this money and use it essentially for political activity. Do you feel like it's made a difference thus far?
Well, I think that has yet to be seen. It's still early. It's only been since the end of June. And, you know, there's some anecdotal evidence out there, but I think both sides are kind of keeping their numbers close to their vest, so to speak, and not really publicizing it. I would like to think that individuals are getting their choice and their voice in what they want to do. However, one of the reasons that I'm on, you know, so much of a breakneck schedule is that we're seeing a tremendous amount of misinformation that the unions are putting out about this case and about the unions and the fact that, you know, they're accusing me of saying that I'm going to end collective bargaining. Well, that's totally false. And they're saying that, you know, if you're not a member of the union, you're going to lose your pension. Well, that's false because your pension normally comes from the employer, not the union. And a whole slug of other misinformation. And so because of that misinformation, you know, and the like, you know, people are getting noticeably confused as to what they are and able to do. And all we're trying to do is say, look, here's the facts. This is what the ruling says. You make up your own choice. We're not here to end collective bargaining. We're not here to say that we're going to stop unions. We're not here to say, you know, that unions are going to go away. Unions have a place. They really do.
We're talking with Mark Janis, who was the successful plaintiff in the Supreme Court's Janis case, the decision coming down in June. Also with us, Sacramento Bee, writer of the State Worker column, Adam Ashton. Adam, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I know it's only been a few months, but what are you seeing so far with California public employees?
So I'm in Sacramento. I tend to cover state workers, and I pulled the state controller data for dues payroll deductions. And from June to now, total union membership is up just a little bit among the state worker unions. And the gains in the state worker unions tend to be in either the unions that had contract negotiations this summer, because this was a good year to negotiate a contract. The correctional officers, engineers, and scientists all got contracts with 4 and 5% raises with no new deductions, so they had a good story to tell. Their membership went up. Also, public safety unions tended to gain members this summer. They might be calling members or calling workers who were fair share fee payers and saying, hey, maybe you didn't know this, but you're not in the union. Do you want to join? So those groups tended to gain members. More general unions like SEIU tended to lose members, and that is kind of those losses were offset in among total membership by the gains in the public safety unions.
Now, some of the unions there's a particular time where people can exit the union. There's like a window. You were writing about that, and explain that a bit.
Yeah, most of the unions have a maintenance of membership clause, and you can't get out until just before the contract expires. Other unions have asked people to sign a card where they commit to membership for a year. And the argument from the unions for that is that they don't want to have someone sign up just because they know that person knows he's in trouble and wants a labor rep and then quit. So the union would spend money on representation and then lose the member. So they ask people to commit for a year. The argument against that is maybe they're just trying to lock someone in and keep them paying.
And then some unions have done away with that that exit window, right, and allow people to leave at any time?
So SEIU Local 1000, which is the biggest union in state government, and CTA told me that they are letting people go. Mark maybe knows otherwise, but that's what I heard. And I know I called people I trust, and they told me, yeah, that's the policy for now. Maybe there's cases where that's not happening, but at least those two are saying for the moment we are letting people go.
And let me bring into the conversation the legal director for the California Teachers Association, which was just mentioned, representing a third of a million public school teachers. Jesus Quiñones, thank you, sir, for being with us. Is CTA allowing teachers to leave the union should they choose to do so at any time?
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me. It's CTA policy, which I believe is consistent with labor law in the state of California, that a valid request to resign membership must be honored by the labor organization. And we comply with that so long as we can verify where the request is from. We will honor that request to resign. We haven't seen many of those, notwithstanding the very well-funded attempts by anti-union organizations throughout the country to push for union members to drop their membership. There haven't been many of them, but as I said, to the extent that we receive a valid resignation, we will honor those.
We're talking with Jesus Quiñones of the California Teachers Association. Justice Elena Kagan wrote the dissent in the Janis case, and she said it would have large-scale consequences. She predicted public employee unions will lose a secure source of financial support. State and local governments that thought fair share provisions furthered their interests will need to find new ways of managing their workforces. Across the country, the relationships of public employees employees and employers will alter in both predictable and wholly unexpected ways. That was the prediction of Justice Elena Kagan. Mark Janus, plaintiff in the case, it doesn't sound like we're seeing that happen to this point.
No, we're not. And you know, the one thing that I have to object to is that, you know, on the union side, you know, they're tainting, you know, organizations that are trying to get, you know, the truth out to individual workers or groups of workers as anti-union. We're not anti-union. All we're trying to do is say, look, here's the choice under the ruling. You make your own decision. And quite frankly, if you want to join, God bless you. Go ahead. Do it. But what we're also seeing that the unions are doing in general is they like I've got an AFSCME pledge card that I was able to get a copy of because I had an individual send it to me. And that card said that you are signing up to be a member of that union in perpetuity, and or an evergreen clause is what some people will call it, which means that even if you leave that public sector job and go take another job in the private sector, you still have to pay those dues. Or if you retire, you still have to pay those dues. Now, why are the unions having to put those clauses into the pledge cards?
I don't see how that would be legal to require you to pay dues to a union in which you're no longer working the job. Jesus Quiñones, you're an attorney. Can you speak to that?
I'm not aware of any such provisions, and you're absolutely right that they would be unenforceable. Certainly CTA doesn't have anything like that at all. And in terms of who's misrepresenting the effect of the Janus decision, I really am concerned that the misrepresentations are coming from those who are hoping that people will drop their memberships both in CTA and in other public sector unions. What's clear is that the Janus decision was only about the question of whether non-member fair share fee payers could be compelled to pay. And notwithstanding 40 years of precedent in which the Supreme Court had said that that was lawful, so long as you didn't take money that was earmarked for political spending, in local and state or national political races, that was a reasonable fee to charge, a fair share fee for getting the representation of your union.
We'll continue our conversation with the California Teachers Association, Jesus Quiñones, also with us Mark Janus, who was the plaintiff in the landmark Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME. Also with us Adam Ashton of the Sacramento Bee, who's been looking at California state public employees. And we'll also talk with Will Swaim, the president of the California Policy Center, which is working to get the word out to union members about the Janus decision. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. In the several months since the Janus decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, what effect has it had on public employee unions? Have a large number of members decided they're not going to pay so-called fair share fees for collective bargaining on their behalf, those who've already withdrawn their membership? Doesn't appear it's yet had that effect. With us, talk about it, Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. Will, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
One of the things that the critics have said about your organization, just reading about, is that you're really, the argument is you're anti-union. You're trying to get people to quit their unions and to diminish the political power that public employee unions have in California. Your response to that?
Well, certainly if unions lose membership income, which is what Mr. Quiñones' group, the CTA, the California Teachers Association, is most concerned about, their political power will be diminished. And it's hard to see how outside, well-funded right-wing groups are responsible for misinformation. The unions pull in $2.7 million per day in income. $2.7 million. I can tell you that California Policy Center doesn't have $2.7 million in a year. So the well-fundedness is on the union side, and they've been preparing for this eventuality since the Friedrichs case. That's Friedrichs versus CTA. going back now 3 years. So they've been building their barricade with new laws to prohibit members from exiting, to make it impossible for public employees to actually know what their rights are. That's the real challenge here. It's going to take time, you know, to argue that after 4 months we can make a critical analysis, I think, is way too early.
Well, isn't it quite possible that for a number of public employees who may not even want to be members of the union, they accept the idea of the fair share concept and support the idea that the union receive compensation for negotiating on their behalf?
Well, keep in mind, Larry, that the unions want it both ways. They fought in court and in Sacramento to make sure that only they had the right to represent workers. Now that they're required to do what they said they wanted to do, they turn it into a burden for them, right? So they want to represent all the workers on the one hand. On the other hand, they say we must be paid to do this representation. No, I don't think they get to have it both
but
ways.
But I thought that the other side of that is that governmental entities preferred that as well, because then they didn't have to negotiate with a labor organization and negotiate with a bunch of other individuals as well. This made it easier for governments.
Well, it's nice that it makes it easier for some government officials or for the union, but it's not consistent with the Constitution. That's what the Supreme Court said. You can't make somebody, the government cannot make somebody join a political organization. That's the bottom line, right?
Mr. Quinones, California Teachers Associate, what do you think has been misrepresented in the efforts of Mr. Janus and the organization working with him?
Well, one thing that's been misrepresented is whether members, the arrangements, that the private arrangements that members have with their unions are covered by the Janus decision. And they clearly are not. Janus, as I said, only applied to whether non-members could be compelled to pay the fair share fee. And notwithstanding the 40 years of precedent, the Supreme Court on June 27th said that was unlawful. But let's be clear, unions are exclusive representatives because they represent a majority of the workforce. It's a democratic process. It's a legal process that California by law requires. You don't become an exclusive representative without having majority support. And once you have majority support, those employees want to keep the union as a representative, because the union, with the dues that it receives from members, negotiates contracts, defends employees in disciplinary processes where necessary. They provide professional support. They help to train teachers and nurses.
The other side of that is, though, that if you have an employee who thinks that the union isn't really serving her or his interests, they don't really have any leverage. Doesn't this in some ways give employees leverage that the union now has to make the case for why those fair share fees are earned by the union?
That's absolutely right, and that's why membership is not dropping, as some people predicted. The question is, what does the union provide? And I think most union members are realizing more than ever that they need the support of their colleagues and of their union. So they're not rushing to drop their memberships and join these organizations that want to undermine unions, not only in California, but throughout the country.
All right. I have less than a minute left. Let me go back to Mr. Janus, the plaintiff in the case. So what are you hoping in the appearances that you're making the effect of this will be?
Well, I'm hoping to get the message out that, you know, that workers do have rights and they do have a choice. And, you know, in response, I have to ask, okay, the unions did ask for, you know, that exclusive representation. But when did that occur? Did it occur 20 years ago? Did it occur 25, 30 years ago? And where is the recertification of that union? Because we're finding that a majority of union public sector workers never voted for that you know, that union representation.
Because of all the
turnover, sure. Yeah, because of all the turnover. And so why are we not doing a recertification, you know, maybe every 1 or 2 or 3 years or with every contract cycle?
We'll have to leave that right there. Mark Janus with us, plaintiff in the Supreme Court's Janus decision. Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. And my thanks to Jesus Quiñones, California Teachers Association, Adam Ashton of the Sacramento Bee.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Coming up a little bit later this hour, In-N-Out Burger's 70th anniversary. Yesterday, it turned 70. And we're going to talk about your favorite In-N-Out memory or experience, why In-N-Out has the kind of cult status that it does. I'll share an experience I had at In-N-Out many years ago that was rather unusual. That's coming up a little bit later right here on Air Talk. We'll also speak with Steve Knight, who is the incumbent for the congressional district in North Los Angeles County that includes Santa Clarita, the high desert area, Palmdale, Lancaster, North San Fernando Valley. Last week we had on his challenger. So we're going to be talking with the congressman coming up just a few minutes from now. But first, it's politics throughout the West, where a number of states that have seen significant numbers of Californians move there are warning that if Democrats get elected in their states, that their states are going to end up just like ours. Here's an example. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick running for re-election.
Radical. Now add this.
Radicalifornia?
That's what you get when you bring radical left-wing policies to your state.
Oh, policies that already failed in California.
Yeah. Jared Polis wants to turn Colorado into radical
values that protect innocent life and liberty. And they celebrate those who take a knee during our national anthem. Truth is, Democrats want to turn Texas into California. Well, I'm not about to let that happen. What about you?
Actually, those were other candidates. We just heard what their campaign messages were. So you hear the threat about becoming like California. This is something that we heard a lot, you know, back during the recession when the whole tech bubble burst and so many Californians moved to states like Arizona, Nevada, to Oregon, and people that had been longtime residents expressing concerns that Californians were moving to other states but wanting to bring a California lifestyle with them. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, particularly if you're a listener to Air Talk who lives in one of the neighboring states that has seen significant numbers of Californians arrive. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With us to talk about how this is playing out is Colton Lockhead, Capitol Bureau Chief and politics reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Colton, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So what are you hearing from your readers of the RJ or forum up in the Reno area? How much of this is being used as a sort of threat changing Nevada's historic character?
Oh, it's been a big part of the campaign process, especially for some of the key Republicans running in, you know, statewide races. There was a big fundraiser back in August for Republican governor candidate Adam Laxalt. It's called the Basque Fry. It's something he's held down in kind of the rural part of the state for the last 4 years. And kind of the big overarching theme of that fundraiser was that if Republicans don't win in Nevada this year, that it's going to become, quote unquote, East California.
And what issue does that raise for Laxalt supporters?
What do you mean?
What sort of fears? What are they? What are the negatives of California that they're invoking?
Oh, I see. Yeah, there. It's kind of the usual that we've heard. You know, higher taxes, housing crisis. You know, red tape on businesses. Same things that have been used. Same kind of rhetoric that's been used to kind of hit California for the last probably several years.
Well, Nevada, also kind of like Arizona, has had a long sort of libertarian streak, you know, live and let live. And it, has that been a theme, too, that that California's sort of governmental control of your life is potentially coming to Nevada?
Yeah, I think that's probably a big part of it. Nevada does, especially outside of, you know, the urban hubs of Clark and Washoe County, Las Vegas and Reno. You definitely have a stronger libertarian streak, where people just don't want any form of government to interfere with their lives. And California, to a lot of them, is kind of the epitome of what governmental interference looks like. You know, the big government, big state, huge budget, higher taxes. It's everything that a lot of people move. Frankly, a lot of people do move to the rural parts of Nevada from California, they've said, to escape that.
Now, how's this playing out in the senatorial race you've got?
Right. It's kind of become, you know, California in that race has become kind of the boogeyman that the Republican Dean Heller is trying to kind of portray and trying to say that his really trying to link his Democratic opponent, Rep. Jackie Rosen, really trying to link her to California. You know, whether it's kind of trying to point out how many donors and how much money she gets in her campaign from California donors to other things, talking about, I think on Twitter he's had you know, tweets and ads saying, you know, quote unquote, we can't let California liberals take over our great state. So it's been a big part of that campaign.
This Devin Nunes was even brought in, the member of Congress from the Central Valley. I understand he did an appearance as well.
Right. And that was, you know, that was back at that that August fundraiser again for Adam Laxalt, the Basque Fry. Nunes was there kind of warning people, effectively warning Republicans in Nevada that, you know, I've seen this firsthand, that, you know, that he had seen the effects of California's, you know, liberalization firsthand, and it's not something that Republicans should want to have happened in Nevada.
It'll be interesting to see how strong this message is or isn't, and if the, you know, California as the boogeyman ends up convincing significant numbers of Nevadans to support the Republicans. You have any sense from polling at this point if that message is connecting?
Not really. There hasn't been too many polls as of recently, and especially nothing where the California message or the anti-California message that's being pushed by Republicans has really been able to be gauged. It's something that I'm really interested to see, because right now that is kind of one of the key, if not the key, messaging point for most of the big name Republicans in Nevada. So it'll be really interesting to see whether or not that is enough to rile. It's riling up the base Republicans.
Yeah.
Interesting to see if it'll rile up enough of the, you know, moderate-leaning Republicans or, you know, right-leaning independents.
Well, and also, it's going to be interesting to see also you Democrats, because I assume they're not saying the opposite. Yes, I will help make this like California. They're not running on California, I assume.
Right, and especially I think you've seen that in the Senate race. Jackie Rosen's ran a handful of ads in Nevada, talking about how she has stood up to Nancy Pelosi in the House, basically trying to, they're not, I would say Democrats aren't necessarily addressing it, they're more or less trying to not necessarily talk about it. They know that they don't want to say that they're going to turn Nevada into California. That's not something that I don't think would message well on either side. But it's they're focused more on, I think, the Trump effect. They're focused more on things like health care and really kind of going after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act as well.
Colton, thanks for being with us and describing what you're seeing in Nevada politics. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Colton Lockhead is Capitol Bureau Chief and Politics Reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. With us from the Colorado Sun, political reporter, and also the craft beer writer. I love that, combining the two. John Frank. John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how big a theme has this been in the races there in Colorado?
This was one of the first themes that Republicans debuted in the governor's race. What we saw is that the Republican Governors Association, you played that ad a moment ago, was labeling the Democratic candidate as Radic California, particularly aiming at his policies. The text of the ad kind of says it all. It says, you know, California has high taxes, crazy regulations that destroy jobs, and radical ideas like single-payer health care. And they're saying that our Democratic candidate for governor, Jared Polis, wants to bring those policies here to Colorado. He does have some similarities in policies, but this attack is mostly aimed at kind of fear-mongering among Republicans. I spoke to a Republican voter just on Saturday who brought this up on her own, this idea that California, as she called it, may emerge if Democrats win the governor's race. So it's not quite clear how much it affects independent voters in Colorado and affiliated voters that really decide our elections here, but it's definitely a rallying cry for Republicans.
Hmm. And is there a general sense of Coloradans that with all the Californians that have moved there, it's had a negative effect on the state?
Colorado is at a pinch point right now, particularly in terms of growth. We're seeing our highways become very congested and not having a way to pay for them or expand them. We are seeing a turning point where the state seems to be moving in a more liberal direction when it's been traditionally Republican decades ago, and then a purple state for the last few election cycles. And we've got a Democratic candidate who's pushing pretty bold Democratic ideas. The Republicans pointed to Governor Jerry Brown signing a law and mandates carbon-free electricity by 2045. That is pretty similar to a policy that the Democratic candidate for governor in Colorado has advocated throughout this campaign. So there are some significant policy comparisons. Now, whether this works is a different question. It remains to be seen how the Californians here in Colorado respond to this. But what it does appeal to is the folks who have been here a long time, who don't necessarily like the direction the state's going, who feel like it's changing too much with our significant growth. I mean, Colorado and Denver have been one of the fastest growing states and cities in the nation in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, the suburbs around Denver have just exploded. I can't believe last time I was there just how much the city has grown on the perimeter. John Frank with us from the Colorado Sun, political reporter and also craft beer writer at the paper. One thing is so clear in these states where Republicans are running against the Californization or whatever you want to call it, no one is running on the opposite. No one is saying, I'll make you just like California. I guess that that says something about our image elsewhere pretty clearly. John, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. Also with us from the Texas Tribune, politics reporter Patrick Svitek. Patrick, thanks for joining us. What are you seeing in the way of TV and radio ads and California mentions there?
Yeah, I mean, California bashing has long been a pretty routine practice in Texas politics, especially in statewide races, where in Texas, obviously, statewide offices are completely controlled by Republicans. And so, especially in the fall of these elections, and, you know, even back during the primaries as kind of a base motivator tactic, you're always hearing about, you know, the prospect of Democrats wanting to turn Texas into California. And we've seen that play out in already numerous ways in the statewide races this time. You played that ad from the lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, you know, making the same point about not letting Texas turn into California. In the U.S. Senate race, we've heard this quite a bit. You know, the Democratic challenger to Ted Cruz, Beto O'Rourke, has set all these fundraising records. And one of the top things that you hear from Cruz supporters is that, you know, this is money flowing in from out of state, flowing in from predominantly, you know, liberals in California who are excited about this guy. Of course, the truth in those cases has a little more nuance. Both candidates could, you know, raise money and get money from California. but it's definitely weaponized against the Democrat in the race much more. And so it's long been a dominant theme, and it continues to be this cycle.
You're based in Austin, which has seen a lot of Californians move to Austin, quality of life and employment opportunities. You've had a tech and general economic boom around the Austin area, much more affordable housing than we have here. Yet, what's the sense of longer time residents in that community there, the capital, as to the California effect of those newcomers coming in?
Yeah, well, I think Austin in particular welcomes the newcomers from California, and probably the people of Austin don't have too much of a problem with Californians coming, because Austin is already a very liberal and strongly Democratic city. And to that point, I just add that even within Texas politics, Austin is a foil in and of itself.
Okay. It's the California of Texas. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Rick Perry, when he was governor, used to call it the blueberry and the tomato soup or something like that. He had some kind of line like that. And so Austin, like California, is already kind of a political foil in Texas, to the point that you have people running statewide, running to represent Austin, I might add, who are still using Austin as kind of a foil and making fun of how, liberal it is and how it's, in some ways out of step with the values of the rest of Texas, or at least the more rural parts.
Patrick, thank you so much. Really appreciate your sharing what's going on there in Texas politics and how California is portrayed. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Politics reporter for the Texas Tribune, Patrick Svitek, with us. So kind of fun hearing in Nevada, in Colorado, in Texas, how California is portrayed there. Republican candidates who have used perceptions of California to try and get support, arguing that if Democrats are elected, it'll bring all the negative stuff of California to their state. Chelsea in Cerrito says, I lived in Austin and in Colorado, and there were a lot of Angelenos who moved there after the L.A. riots. This fear of California has always been part of the conversation, and I think the way that those from California moved in drove up housing prices bred a lot of resentment from the locals. And Doug in Buena Park says, I relocated to Florida because I was a soldier in the Army from California. I've been in Florida for 7 years. Seems to me California's really turned its back on average citizens. The cost of living here is just too high. That's Doug. We'll continue on Air Talk. Our focus will be on the congressional district, which includes northern Los Angeles County, the high desert communities of Palmdale and Lancaster. We'll talk with incumbent Congressman Steve Knight coming right up in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We remind you that all the candidate interviews that we're doing, the debates on the ballot propositions, all of that can be found by visiting elections.laist.com. You'll find all the information there, and also find our voter cram session, which is all the California ballot propositions, analyze the pros and cons, who supports, who's in opposition. You'll find that as well at kpecc.org. Joining us is Republican member of Congress, Steve Knight. He represents the 25th Congressional District. He is previously a Palmdale City Councilman, also served in the California State Legislature representing this area. He's a U.S. Army veteran, also been with the Los Angeles Police Department. In fact, he was born at Edwards Air Force Base within his district. Congressman Knight, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
So you are in a close fight here in a district the Democrats have identified as one they believe they might be able to shift into their column. First of all, as you look at the challenge that you're getting from Democrat Katie Hill, do you see significant demographic shifts in your district which might call on you to change some of your future votes?
Well, I think people elected me because they like the way I think. I'm kind of a look at the problem and try and fix the problem kind of person. I am a Republican, and I do believe in the Republican kind of philosophy. But I'm also understanding that I'm an elected official that needs to solve problems and get things done. So I think that's why people elect me. I think that's why they continue to elect me. and we'll continue doing that. But we are. I am a Republican, and I do believe in the Republican philosophy, and I do think that that's a far better philosophy than the other side.
Katie Hill, in her ads, has brought up, you know, President Trump and your voting record, attempts to tie you to the president as opposed to just the Republican Party. So what is your view of President Trump? And do you think that there is significant distance between the president, his populism, and the Republican views that you espouse?
I don't know. You know, my opponent likes to use a extremely liberal group's view of something, and they pull out a number that this ultra-liberal group stated. And so, you know, it's almost comical the way she does that. But we've been very clear. We've been very clear with every president. You know, when I disagreed with President Obama, nobody got up in arms and said, why are you disagreeing with the president? And then when I disagree with President Trump, people say, why aren't you disagreeing with him more? You know, I'm the representative for the 25th district. If I believe the president's doing something great, I applaud him. If I believe he's done something that really doesn't fit our district or my beliefs in this district, then we say something. But that also comes down to I served for 2 years with President Obama and our economy was stagnant. And I've served 2 years with President Trump, and our economy is exploding so much that we have more jobs than we have people to fill them. So I think that the people that yell at me that I'm not disagreeing with them are people that hate President Trump. And, you know, we've got to kind of look at the record. This economy is explosive right now, and it is because of policies that we have adopted.
We're talking with Republican member of Congress, Steve Knight. He represents the 25th Congressional District, which includes portions of northern Los Angeles and Ventura counties. Santa Clarita is within his district, Palmdale, Lancaster, portions of north Los Angeles County and into Ventura County as well. Congressman, what about immigration? For a number of California Republicans, that's one of the major areas where they do split with the president. What's your view, the best way you think of dealing with the U.S. immigration challenge?
Well, it is a challenge. It's very convoluted. It's very difficult. It's interesting. I just walked out of a meeting at one of our community colleges where we were talking about immigration, and then I got protested by people who said I wasn't doing enough. So, you know, you try and do what's right and make people happy, and then you find that some people just wouldn't be happy if you help them in everything. But I think that I'm fairly problem solver when it comes to immigration. I have said all along that I believe border security has got to be that first staple, and then we can talk about other issues like DACA, and we can work through the DACA issue that is affecting people and affecting this country. But, you know, I think that too many people, especially on the other side, want to see immigration as a political football and something that they think they can win on by just not doing anything with it. And so that's what's happening.
How would you beef up border security? Do you support the president's wall or do you support other measures in lieu of a wall?
Well, I was a police officer for 18 years, so I know the amount of drugs that come over from the three drug cartels in Mexico, the amount of sex trafficking that comes over, and the terrorist problem. So I would go for an all of the above. I think that there are places where you have to have that wall, that border wall. There are places where you can use high-tech security. But then the other part that people don't talk about is boots on the ground and then the people that can go through the whole adjudication process. That means judges. That means the attorneys and the whole process there. So I believe you've got to tackle the whole item. And border security should be number one with a lot of people, with everyone's mind. If we had a terrorist attack right now, everyone would be on the border security. So why not make sure that our border is strong and we can cut down the drugs and sex trafficking and stop any terrorist activity?
Well, of course, you know, critics of the wall say that for the amount of money spent, that's not the best way to do it, that there are other more high-tech solutions and staffing solutions that would make more sense than that sort of a physical barrier.
There are ways that we can do this, but there are certain places where you have to have that barrier. But we've seen high tech youth in Afghanistan with our troops and in other areas. I've been to Israel several times and I've seen different items there. I'm all for it, as long as we can make sure that we are impacting the areas that we want to. That's drugs, crime, and illegal immigration.
We're talking with Congressman Steve Knight, joining us, running for the 25th District, seeking re-election. And he's facing a challenge from Democrat Katie Hill, who was the former executive director of People Assisting the Homeless, PATH, housing nonprofit. Congressman Knight, on health care, what would you like to see, if not the Affordable Care Act, what would you like to see in lieu of that?
Well, it's interesting. I think that Republicans and Democrats are working together on several different items. We're working on items for prescription drugs now. But we have done something right in our district that's nowhere else in the country, and that is a health care kind of hybrid program for our veterans, where veterans can go right to an urgent care here in their district instead of going to a veterans hospital and get care right in their district. And that's part of health care. And that's working for the vets in our district. It's only in ours, the 25th, and a little bit of the 23rd, Kevin McCarthy's. Nowhere else in the country. So, you know, all the banner that goes back and forth with health care, I think we can do a lot. But we're actually doing something, too. We're putting our money where our mouth is. And we've built a program that affects a population, our veteran population. And we're actually doing something. So I think you get a lot of yelling back and forth by people, and then they never do anything.
But what do you think is the answer? If it's not the ACA, if it's not a so-called Medicare for All, single-payer kind of a program, what role do you think the government should have in health care?
Well, I think that, you know, before Hillary Care, we were talking about a program where Walmart, Walgreens, and Target had all come together and said, hey, we can put a clinic in each one of our businesses. And then everyone would be covered within, I don't know what it was, 15 or 20 minutes anywhere in the country. And I thought, there's a good solution, and we can have a private industry where we can build new products. And I think that that's part of it, too. You know, a 22-year-old male might not need the coverage that I need as a 51-year-old married person with kids. And we should build more products and have the private industry really engaged in that. And then don't fool with something that's working, like Medicare. Medicare's for those three populations, and it's working very well. So if you try and expand that to everyone, then remember, those populations, like those 65-plus and disabled, are not going to be the priority anymore.
Now, Katie,
that are yelling and screaming for that, they're not looking out for the seniors, not looking out for disabled, not looking out for pregnant women.
Katie Hill has argued that you've taken so much money from the insurance industry, nearly $150,000, more than $60,000 from the pharmaceutical industry, that that's made you beholden to the private sector when it comes to health care. Your response to that?
Well, my response would be the same response I say to just about everything my opponent says. She has never, ever done anything. She's never voted. She's never been part of the government that has tried to fix something. And so she thinks that happens, that you are beholden because of something like that. I have never, I never have, never will. We have kind of moved forward with what it is, the leadership of the 25th. But she's never done anything, so we can't say anything about her because we're kind of waiting. We're waiting for her to be a part of a group in the community or to see her in the community. You know, I talked to the town council in her community, and none of them had said they'd ever met her. So, and it's not a big community. So I think that she believes that's how it works, but it doesn't work that way. You actually have to go out and lead your district with your values and what the district needs.
Congressman, just final word from you on why voters in your district should support you.
Oh, we've been clear. I work on the military and aerospace. I work on veteran care. I work on small business. We've been very clear for those 4 years. And we work on the issues of the district, whether it be a local issue or something that affects a group of people in our district. We've been very, very successful. I have passed many pieces of legislation into law with President Obama and President Trump, and I've been just rated as the 73rd most bipartisan member in Congress by a very bipartisan group. So I've kept my word, and I've been very successful at helping this district.
Congressman Knight, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Steve Knight, Republican Congress member, the 25th District, covering portions of northern Los Angeles and Ventura counties. It includes Lancaster, Palmdale, Santa Clarita, surrounding communities. You can share your comments about his candidacy in this district that Democrats are hoping to flip blue. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming right up, it's the 70th anniversary of In-N-Out, the 95th anniversary of El Cholo, the Los Angeles legend. We'll talk about what this means for food lovers in Southern California after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. When Harry Snyder started his hamburger chain 70 years ago yesterday, doubtfully would have guessed what would have happened to In-N-Out, as it has become a Western U.S. phenomenon. It's not a national chain, but safe to say that people in all 50 states have heard of In-N-Out. It has become a cult favorite. The restaurants over the years have evolved and grown. But did you know that it was Harry Snyder who actually built the two-way speaker in his garage to figure out how best to take orders as cars were going through his first drive-in in Baldwin Park in the San Gabriel Valley? Joining us to talk about the history of In-N-Out and to hear your stories is Elena Shatkin, who's food editor at LAist. Elena, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
70 years, and, you know, we think, of course, about McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's and these huge national chains, but none of them have the kind of loyalty of In-N-Out.
No, it's true. I'm a big fan of In-N-Out. You know, when I drive to and from Northern California on the I-5, I will literally pass dozens of other McDonald's, Burger King's, what have you.
Button Willow In-N-Out.
Yeah, there's right. Like two or three In-N-Outs there now, and I know where they all are, and yeah. I will pass other restaurants to go there specifically. And I know I'm not the only one, so that's the kind of loyalty it inspires. And I think they've just done a really smart thing. They haven't branched out into all these crazy foods of like yogurt cups and chicken wraps and, you know, kale salads or whatever. They're like, no, we do a couple things. We do burgers, we do fries, and we do milkshakes. Thank you very much. That is all. And we do them well.
I was making a solo drive. I was headed to Albuquerque. And so I stopped for the night in Kingman, Arizona. I went to In-N-Out, which is across the street from the hotel where I was staying. And I was so tired, I didn't even want to read. I was just by myself. So I set myself up to have my burger looking down the prep line at In-N-Out, just sort of, you know, entertainment. And I was amazed at the way everybody moved, so in sync, getting out of each other's way. It was like a honed machine, and it just made me think about, you know, all the time that employees invest, because I know they hold on people longer than other chains, like that's part of the efficiency that they exhibit.
Yeah, well, efficiency is a crucial factor in any fast food operation. How fast can you make those burgers? How fast can you get them out? How quickly can, you know, you get people in and out of the restaurants? So an In-N-Out really does it better than most. And they do it with, I think, some of the friendliest employees. You know, I've been at that crazy Button Willow In-N-Out on, I think it's like the day after Thanksgiving when everybody is driving in and out. And the line is literally out the door. And the employees are just as cool and collected and friendly as can be. It's I couldn't do that job on that day, I will say.
So I'd love to hear from listeners. If you worked at In-N-Out or work there now, I welcome your memories. Maybe some of your most notable experiences. Maybe you share some secrets about the training process and why In-N-Out seems to be such a different experience for the staff that's working in the restaurants. If you also have a favorite In-N-Out memory that you want to share, something notable that happened at an In-N-Out, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We should also mention, even older, is El Cholo, the local small chain of Mexican restaurants, which celebrates its 95th birthday this month, Elena.
Yeah, they are. And today they are offering a killer deal. So for only 95 cents, you can get their most popular item, which is their number one combo. It's got rice and beans. I think it's got, maybe a taco and
an enchilada. It's a taco enchilada combo.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
Something like that. Only 95 cents. And it's good all day at all six of their locations. And there's one in Pasadena and Santa Monica and Santa Ana. So they're all around. And, yeah, to celebrate, you know, probably L.A.'s most, you know, at least it's certainly its oldest Mexican restaurant chain.
And, of course, I think of them, the blue corn tamale, which
is green corn tamale.
Green corn, excuse me, tamale, mm-hmm. which is such a part of the experience of El Cholo.
Yeah, that's probably their single most popular item. It's available starting in May, usually through September or October. So I hope they still have them. I'm not sure this year. It depends each year a little bit. But yeah, that's a huge, huge part of the experience there. People love that. And, you know, for a lot of people, part of why this restaurant was so important is that it helped bring, like for a lot of people who weren't Mexican or didn't grow up eating Mexican food at home, it might have been their first taste yeah. of what Mexican food was. And yeah, they Americanize a bunch of things, sure. But still, it helps bring those flavors and palates and spreads them, you know, to a wider audience and helps make Mexican food another essentially American cuisine, kind of like Italian or Chinese food before it.
Yeah, it was many years later that I wish I could remember his name, the El Torito guy from the Valley then started that chain, which of course became national and yeah. and massive before it was bought out. 866-893-KPCC. Laura in the Pico Fairfax District said, I have worked at In-N-Out for 33 years. Still works there, says it's so family oriented. The owner treat us so well, and when you love working there, you can't help but be a great employee. That's Laura in Pico Fairfax, 33 years.
Well, there are partly, you know, there are a couple reasons for that. One is that In-N-Out actually pays its employees, even its starting employees, just, you know, your basic teenagers working the line, a higher starting wage than most other fast food restaurants, which is great because it helps with turnover, a major problem in the fast food industry. And the other big thing that In-N-Out doesn't do is it doesn't franchise. So it's still family owned. The woman who is the head of it is the granddaughter, the only granddaughter of the founders. It's totally, you know, it's still privately held. It's not publicly held. So there's not this pressure on the company to just, you know, grow big and expand for the sake of expansion and meet stockholder demands. So they don't have that same frantic pressure, I think, to keep opening more and more franchises. They grow really slowly and really carefully.
And they've stayed in the West, so their distribution, they're able to get the fresh food out to those locations, all things, you know, which are much more difficult for the massive national chains to do. Let's see, we have Jazz Chick writes on the page, I sometimes like sitting on the grass at the LAX In-N-Out, the one right there in Westchester.
Oh, yeah.
And I watch the planes fly over as I enjoy my double-double animal style. Simple pleasures. That's Jazz Chick writing on the Air Talk page. Pippi writes, I have out-of-state friends who come to town. The first and last stops are In-N-Out. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Alex in Atwater Village. Alex, share with us your favorite In-N-Out memory.
Hey there. I'm originally from the East Coast, so when I would visit my family out west, it was always an exciting trip to In-N-Out, and especially because I loved the secret menu and that little secret Bible verse on the bottom of the cups. and that always felt pretty hip. And, yeah, I've seen now, I think even McDonald's having a secret menu, and I just always loved that aspect of it, where it looks like such a small menu, but there's so much more.
Yeah, I didn't realize McDonald's had tried to emulate that, but it does. It gives you that insider thing. There's sort of the genius of In-N-Out. You can be in a line with, you know, dozens of other people, but you feel like it's your thing, just as you're describing, Alex. I appreciate it. And the Bible verse, I think, is really interesting because, you know, obviously the Snyders were people of faith, and so that's a personal expression of their Christian faith with the Bible verse. And for some people who look at that, if they are themselves people of faith, they like having that reminder. But I think for other people who aren't even religious, there's something very personal about it. Nonetheless, you're never going to see a Bible verse at McDonald's or Wendy's. So even if people aren't religious, there is something that's kind of homey and personal about it.
It is nice to see the personal imprint of, you know, at any business, of the person who owns the business, some of their personal, their values, whether or not, you know, you share their beliefs. I agree. It's nice to see that.
Sean Highland Park, stay on the line. I want to hear your In-N-Out story. It's a fun one. Do you have a great In-N-Out story to share? I have a funny one that includes Steve Julien, the late Steve Julien, our Morning Edition host here, that takes way back in Steve and my friendship that involves In-N-Out. And I'll tell you about that coming up a little bit later. But I want to hear your In-N-Out story. Elena Shatkin is with me, the food editor for LAist. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. The original In-N-Out was in Baldwin Park in the San Gabriel Valley. It opened up 70 years ago yesterday. In fact, there's a replica of the original In-N-Out that's just very close to where the first one was. And they have that open generally on weekends. Corporate headquarters in Irvine, but still has their flagship station right there on Francisquito in Baldwin Park. We're remembering In-N-Out's 70 years as they celebrated it yesterday, and your favorite memories of In-N-Out. Shaw in Highland Park, share your experience.
Hi, yeah. So back in high school, we went out one night at a house party and ended up at In-N-Out at maybe 1:30 in the morning. And as we were eating our burgers, a high-speed car chase actually ended there. The car ended up pulling right into the driveway, and then about a minute later, the streets were full of police, and they all had their guns drawn, and we were just sitting there eating our double-doubles, watching the whole thing.
With the show playing out in front. That was the Riverside In-N-Out?
Yeah, that was Riverside. I believe the one on Indiana.
Yeah, on Indiana, yeah. Yeah, I used to actually worked in radio briefly in Riverside. Shaw, love the memory. Thanks so much. 866-893-KPECC. Valerie in Tustin, your favorite In-N-Out memory.
I have two. We used to keep the map in our glove box in the 80s when my friends and I were in college so that we knew where they all were because there was only like 10 to 15. But I also went to UCSB, and at that point in time, the furthest north one was up off of Winnetka in the valley. So we would do In-N-Out runs on Friday night and bring our students, or you know, our friends from Northern California down and introduce them to In-N-Out.
That's great. And there was another one you were going to share?
There's one that we used to keep the maps.
The maps, yeah, okay.
You know where they were, because I had a good friend that went to UC Riverside. So when we were together, we'd be driving all over Southern California trying to figure out where they were.
I love it. Valerie, thanks so much for sharing it. Jeffrey in Indio says, when I was in Las Vegas, I was in a very long line at In-N-Out. Once I finally got my burger, and I was heading back to L.A., and someone else offered me $40 for my double because they didn't want to wait in line for a half hour like I had done. Jeffrey, I love it. That's a lot of money for a double-double. But I don't know if you accepted that or not. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be good to know.
$40 for a half hour, that's pretty good pay rate.
It'd be really tempting, but still, I might keep
the burger.
Depends
how hungry he was, yeah. Paige messaged on our AirTalk Facebook page, I worked at In-N-Out for 6 years, from 2000 to 2006, while I went to college and high school. One reason why In-N-Out is so successful is the In-N-Out Golden Rule, which states, number one, the customer is always right. Number two, if by chance the customer makes a mistake, refer to rule number one. I still say to this day that if I ever needed a second job or lost my job, I'd go back in a heartbeat. I love it. Thank you so much. That's Paige messaging us on the AirTalk Facebook page. Karome, in Culver City, your favorite In-N-Out story.
Well, in college, Larry, my friends and I got this idea that we could have more than a double-double, and it became a competition as to how far we could set the bar. And we went to 4 and 6 and 8, and ultimately nobody could get over 11 by 11, 11 beef by 11 cheese patties.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. But they were able to handle that. That's astonishing.
That was a fork and knife evening.
I would bet. And a little bit of antacid. Karome, thanks so much. Let's see. Tyler, in Burbank, you used to work for In-N-Out?
Yes, I used to work at Store 110 in Burbank.
All right.
I was just there the other day.
And so do you have a particularly good story to share from your time working there?
Yes, so we had a customer, unfortunately, their car broke down in the drive-thru at the order gate, which could not have been more inconvenient for us, but it wasn't their fault. But luckily, the customers were willing to get out of line, park somewhere, even if it was a few blocks away, and come in. And it just shows that that food is really that good if people are willing to wait twice to three times as long for it. So I just wanted to say that it's totally worth it. In and out all day.
Tyler, I what's funny is I always wondered what happens if a car breaks down in the line. Do people get out and just push it out of the way, or you know, how do you deal with it? And that's particularly a bad place right at the order window to have it break down. Let's see. We have Annie posted on the AirTalk page, happy birthday, In and out. We don't keep kosher, so my husband and I have a tradition of breaking Passover and breakfast for Yom Kippur with In-N-Out. We're both native Angelenos, and I've had more than a few dates there. I even got him personalized collar stays that say double-double animal style, no pickles. You are a true devotee. Annie, thanks so much for sharing that. One of my most memorable In-N-Out experiences, Elena, was Steve Julian, our late morning edition host.
Yeah.
Between working in radio, I first met him in Riverside. We worked at the same CBS affiliate news talk station in Riverside. And after he got out of radio for a while, he went into law enforcement. He was a police officer in Baldwin Park, where In-N-Out had that original store
right on
Francisquito. So I was doing a ride-along with Steve one afternoon, and he gets a call on the radio from one of his fellow officers saying, you know, head right over to, and gives the address of the original In-N-Out. So he's wondering, what's this about? It's a rather cryptic message. So we pull up in the patrol car in front of the In-N-Out, the original one, but no longer there. And there is a horse with the rider of the horse eating a burger atop the horse at the original In-N-Out in the middle of the city. Just an oddity of total. They've probably ridden on the trail over at the, you know, 605 freeway and cut over.
That's fantastic. Now, do you think the horse went through the drive-thru lane?
I would assume that it went through the ride-thru, yes.
Would you call it a gallop-thru lane?
I would think so, absolutely. No, it's one of my favorite In-N-Out memories.
That's a great story.
Gabriel in Riverside said, I toured for years with Sharon Jones. You must be a dap king, Gabriel. And they loved In-N-Out. We had a gig in France and then Australia, so we flew real quick to L.A. to get back to In-N-Out. All right, Gabriel. And boy, do we miss Sharon Jones.
Yeah.
One of her interviews toward the end of her life she did with us here on Air Talk. Lady Shatkin, as always, thank you so much, paying tribute to In-N-Out for their 7 decades of serving double doubles and the like.
Thank you, and thank them.
Yeah, we appreciate it. All right, Lena Shatkin, you read her works, food editor at LAist.com. From all of us at Air Talk, have a great afternoon. Fresh Air's next.